back to the cut once again. Professor Jonathan Janssen, Distinguished Professor of Education at Stellenbosch University, past President of the Academy of Science of South Africa, prolific author, formidable participant in society, and well known to the club, is here today to discuss the overhaul of the South African school history curriculum, which has been marred by controversy. And as we can see, history curriculums are being rewritten all over the world, including the US and Russia. And surely we can't be repeating the same mistakes as when I was taught, because I remember even at the age of 12 becoming somewhat suspicious when the finger of God intervened in the Battle of Blood River, or when that gun runner Petra Tiff and the hands of Dingaan would die an equally gruesome but a different death every year. I think once it was assegais, once he was bludgeoned, and I think once impaled or something, depending which grade you were in. But Professor Janssen is here on that theme with the title of his talk, Show Me Your Curriculum, and I'll Show You Who Is in Power. Please welcome the professor.
Thank you very much, and to all of you for being here. I'm in a bit of trouble under pressure, because when I came in, one of you said to me, I got up from a very warm bed to hear you, don't screw it up. So, you know, I will try not to screw it up. I would like to start by thanking teachers and researchers of history and history education for being available for interviews, including a member of the history panel that contributed to this report. Thank you to my research team for content analyses of different kinds of both the current and the proposed new history curriculum. My friend and colleague, Dr. Khali, helped me with some of the statistics and so on. I feel very proud to have my third year education policy students here from Stellenbosch University. They are history majors in Maine. And this morning they started off, some of them, at the school where I've been busy helping for the past 2 years and some at Crestway High School in retreat. I'm very proud of the fact that two of our history teachers, outstanding history teachers, Ms. Kepis and Mr. Miller are here. Very proud also of the history teacher from Masipumalele who is here, and others whom I know. One of my favorite schools besides Crestway is the Law Hill Maritime Academy. Debbie Owen is like an energizer bunny. She doesn't stop in her enthusiasm for raising some of these amazing young people from all over the country in maritime education. First, a disclaimer. I'm going to approach the analysis of the revised history proposal as a curriculum theorist, not as an academic historian, I'm not that, or as a history of education specialist, I'm not that, or as a history teacher, I'm not that either. If you went back, I'm a life sciences teacher, I love the physical sciences, but I'm not a history person, so I will be talking about this curriculum as a curriculum theorist. You might ask, as do my children, Dad, what does a curriculum theorist do? Nothing actually. Well, we ask questions about knowledge, how it is organized, its politics, its poetics, and its purposes. And in that regard, obviously, it's not tied to a particular school subject. A critical curriculum theorist starts from the notion that any curriculum is inevitably a political subject. Think of it this way. When there is a seemingly infinite amount of knowledge from which to draw, you choose or you select what will make it into the curriculum. In other words, you include some things and you exclude other things. That, whether you like it or not, is a political act. What is being proposed that's new in this curriculum? Three things. It is claimed that it is an African-centered curriculum, which I will show you in a minute is a load of nonsense. Secondly, it promises a focus on the long past, not 100 years ago, not even 1,000 years ago, but many thousand years ago, under the notion that the African past is knowable. I didn't think that was an issue, but apparently they have to convince somebody that our past is knowable. And then, really problematic, they propose a rather complex set of methodologies that young people will use in schools, not in archaeology departments, in schools, to reconstruct the past. There's a joke among consultants that a curriculum analyst from a foreign country, a foreign aid agency, landed in an African country, and he was met by a group of local bureaucrats from the government's education department. To save time, the busy consultant made a simple request: show me your curriculum, and I will tell you who's in power. So let's get into it. Here's 10 reasons why this proposed curriculum will fail. Now, if you're old enough, you might remember me writing something with a title like 10 Reasons Why OBE Will Fail. And I was called the son of many things after I wrote that piece. And government tried very hard not to change the OBE curriculum until it became such a disaster that after 3 ministers or 4, they decided, look, this thing is creating huge problems, sort of more or less the problem Donald Trump has. You get screwed in Iran, and you've got to figure out a way how to back out without losing, face. What do I mean by fail? In a very simple sense, why this curriculum will fail to meet its declared intentions. So let's get to it. The first reason this curriculum is dead in the water is that there is no organizing logic behind it. In other words, a logic that states explicitly, why is this change necessary? Why now? Did you discover 32 years later that you're African? What is the theory of change? That is, how will this change unfold under ideal conditions? That is what we curriculum theory calls a theory of change. Okay? That if everything was in order, how will this happen? No clue about that. Peter Calloway, who is, in my view, the doyen of history of education specialists in South Africa, called this in a critique of an earlier version of this thing. He called it unstated principles of selection. You see, to understand what is in and what is out, you need a coherent organizing logic for 2 purposes: to guide teachers with respect to what to do, but also to persuade the public around those key questions. This is history. You will never have this debate in physics, by the way. You would not show up for a debate on mathematics. But history strikes us as something, you know, in which we all have an enormous stake. But I've read all 3 packages, that is grades 4 to 7, grades 8 to 9, and grades 10 to 12, those 3 curriculum packages. I cannot find a logic for why you're selecting some things and not selecting others. This is a very basic. If my honors students did that, I'd fail them at Stellenbosch and send them to UCT. That's a joke, just to keep you awake, you know. So in the absence of an organizing logic, every selection or deselection of content comes across as trivial. Let me give you a few examples of how trivial this thing is. The French Revolution is out, but the Haitian Revolution is in. Hello? Why? Secondly, Jan van Riebeek is out. Turns out he was always out, but Jan van Riebeek is out. And P.W. Botha is in, big time. Don't even know that. So the most serious charge that can be leveled at this curriculum is the charge of triviality. Ordinary language, pettiness. And so the content selected for more than 30 million children is left to the whims of a history panel. Think about that. Secondly, this is a patriotic curriculum, or more directly, a curriculum of the ruling party. Read, you know, it's always interesting, having done curriculum analysis for most of my life, you always look at what people say this thing is not, you know, because they're lying. Okay. So it says this is not a patriotic curriculum. Turns out it is. Its intellectual interests sound noble, but its ideological interests jump off the pages. It is really an ANC curriculum. How else does one explain the fact that Biko and Sobukwe are reduced to three mentions, but P.W. Botha 18? Put differently, while Biko and Sobukwe enjoyed prominence in the grade 12 curriculum, the current one, they are now reduced to a mere 2 hours in 12 years of schooling. In fact, Biko and Sobukwe are completely absent from the compulsory phase, that is, from grades 4 to 9, when everybody must do either social science or history, with the result that children coming from, I tested this with my son in New Zealand earlier this morning, he liked it, with the result that children coming through grades 4 to 9 are more likely to know about Bad Bunny than Bantu Biko. Think about that. I can see some of you old people saying, who the hell is Bad Bunny? The revised curriculum is, in fact, a misrepresentation about who the African is in this African-centered history. You know, in all the talks I've given over the course of my life, there's normally a point at which somebody walks out. This is your chance. Let me repeat. The revised curriculum is, in fact, a misrepresentation about who the African is in this African-centered history. Let me say this as we did in a book on decolonization. There is nothing inherently radical about an African-centered curriculum. Apartheid was, in fact, African-centered. To the extent that it was ethnic or ethnically centered. How often didn't we read about this is Zulu custom, this is Sotho culture. It was always African-centered, which raises the question, who is the African being talked about here? Or around which African is this curriculum being centered? Is this the essentialist African that excludes non-ethnic ways about being African? Is this the xenophobic African who circumscribes South Africanness by including only those inside the colonial borders set up by the Europeans? Or is this a broader progressive pan-Africanist that resets the national debate on what it means to be African in the first place? The silence of the curriculum panel on this matter of grave importance is quite simply stupefying. Number four, this is an African curriculum in its narrow apartheid definition sense, with relatively little about other black people in South Africa. It is for the most part about black Africans as apartheid defined us in scope, range and content, with by the way references to those who fall outside of this narrow meaning. Now those of you who know me well know that I don't think colored identity is a real thing, it's a complete political construction. But in the way it is used in this document, you will notice that colored and Indian appear more often in brackets than outside of brackets. So where is, for example, the concentrated study of indentured labor among Indian South Africans? Do they matter in this curriculum or not? Are they South Africans or not? Chinese and Indian indentured labor sort of goes hand in hand, but the subject occupies little space in the curriculum, thereby diminishing a rich cultural and political heritage concentrated on the east coast of South Africa. We are left with, I quote, this is probably one of the most bizarre statements that intelligent people could make. This is the quote in there. Some Indians, this is after indentured labor, some Indians stayed, adapted, made a decent living, and contributed to culture in the town. Have these fucking people been to Chatsworth? Or Phoenix? It's just nonsense. They made a decent living. Where is the concentrated study of slavery in the Cape and its legacy in contemporary culture, society, and politics? Why has the ruling party always failed to give a full account of this aspect of South African history? Since 94. Is it because Cape slavery is about, okay, forget the word, politics? Like nature abhors a vacuum. And in the absence of a critical account of Cape slavery, you are left with the coons. By the way, you'll find in this curriculum a lot more about slavery in Haiti and the Americas than anywhere else. Number five, the curriculum presents a simplistic sense of history in which overwhelmingly whites are the demons and Africans are angels. Let me repeat that in case you think I'm making this up. The curriculum presents a sense of history in which whites are the demons and Africans are angels. For example, we learn about genocides perpetrated by white people, the Khoi, the Hereros in Namibia, but there's actually nothing about the Rwandan genocide in which Africans killed Africans on an industrial scale in 3 months, 1 million people. While the understandable goal might be to deal with the racist view that Africans are little more than tribalists who kill each other, this panel is shadowboxing with ghosts. For example, if the panel really wants to go into Africa's early history, why focus only on the transatlantic slave trade when more than 41 million people are known to have been enslaved in Africa by other Africans? Even during the transatlantic slave trade, the traffic in human beings would not have been possible without the help of Africans, like the chiefs, capturing around 90% of other Africans from the interior. Why the silence about all of this? So if you want a history curriculum that draws students into learning about the past as a process that is complex, nuanced, and intellectually honest, this is not it. I was in Belfast last year, and the Irish are as funny as the Cape Townians. And we were at the Irish families for dinner, and one of the Irish visitors to the dinner after dinner said to the host, "There is nothing like a good cup of tea." This was not it. There's nothing like a good history curriculum. This is not it. One would think that in a maturing democracy, we have reached the point in which we can tell the story of black history by accounting for both our light, like Ubuntu, and our shadows, genocide, African genocide. Number six, the revised curriculum reveals a serious misrepresentation of South African history. In the compulsory phase, for example, 4 through 9, don't fall off your seat. students will learn nothing about apartheid as a social, economic, and political system, except for brief references to segregated education and women's resistance. Imagine that. The single most important event shaping the political economy of 20th century South Africa was apartheid. And now the majority of children will pass through high school with little knowledge about this cataclysmic episode in our history. Remember that almost two-thirds of high schoolers do not choose to do history in the beyond the compulsory phase, which, by the way, is about the same number as those who do choose mathematical literacy. Put differently, following the compulsory phase, that's social science 4-7, let me repeat, and history 8-9, more than 60% of students will not learn anything about apartheid as a social system. That is a disgrace. I just watched a really moving movie on Netflix. You've got to watch it. Called The Trials of Winnie Mandela. I couldn't watch it in one space. You get so upset, so I had to watch it in small chunks. It is a history I want my grandchildren to learn, so that we never go down that road again. Nothing. Number 7. The basic architecture of the curriculum remains the same as in its CAPS predecessor. It is content heavy, thereby suffocating any pedagogical pretensions about an innovative pedagogy, critical thinking, discovery, etc. As I said, I've worked with my two colleagues here and many others over the past 2 years. The one thing every South African teacher complains about is the content heavy CAPS curriculum and what it disallows in terms of pedagogical exploration. Every day in a classroom, teachers face the challenge of compliance versus comprehension. Do I go back, given the lack of prior knowledge, and rebuild so that the kids at least understand what I'm doing? Or, in fear of the curriculum advisor for the district, I will just tick off that I'm covering the curriculum, even if they don't understand. It's a really difficult ethical choice for a young teacher trying to build a career. The next test or exam looms. The subject advisor is on your back. The pressure is on. And yet, as I will now show in the next point, this content-heavy curriculum expects teachers and their students to perform miracles in terms of methods of teaching and techniques for learning history. Number 8. And so, the single most important reason this curriculum will fail, as in the case of OBE, is that once again it overestimates teacher capacity and ignores the deeply unequal resource contexts within which teachers do their work. For those of you who don't get out very often, out of Bishops or Rondebosch Boys, at the school I'm at, there are 1,146 kids. Today, 120 showed up in this rain. Why? Because they have to walk there, most of them, from Lavendale and from Capricorn near to Musenberg. Okay? They don't have parents who drop them off in 4x4s with umbrellas. There's nothing against rich kids or middle class kids. I'm just saying there's a reality that this curriculum doesn't speak to. It is extremely difficult, and I know this from a book I just did last year on how discovery happens across 21 disciplines. The book is called On Discovery. And the person I chose for archaeology was Innocent Garaye at the University of Pretoria. And the one thing I know for sure, you don't just show up and teach archaeological methods, are you crazy? It's extremely difficult. It involves a lot of science, etc., etc. And so there is no way that a teacher can get into all of that, because that wasn't part of the original training, I suspect, as history teachers. Secondly, the tools and techniques listed, and there's a lot of them, imply equal access to resources that make the ambitions of this curriculum impossible to achieve. We know from curriculum history across the board that such assumptions constitutes what my friend Mary Metcalf, late in life, after helping to screw us over with OBE, calls magical thinking. That is, give you an example. I've been teaching mainly physical sciences, and I'm a life sciences teacher off and on at Crestway for the past 2 years. Did you know? In every statement for the term, what do they call this again? The ATP, the annual teaching plan. In every annual teaching plan, it says you will do a titration. You will do a velocity, you know, that ticker tape thing in physics, velocity in two dimensions. You will do all of this. With what fucking equipment? Where are they going to get this? They're not the St. Cyprians. I mean, I could literally out of my own pocket. I don't mind doing this. It's, you know, it's what we do, Debbie and I, and many of you. I can buy this stuff. But there's Adam Park, there's Guy Litcher, there's Langer. Where, why do you put stuff in when you know it is not going to happen? We're back there with a silly proposal for revised instead of curriculum. You think I'm making this up? Listen to this. This is what's in there. Not for universities. It would be bad enough at university. Students should be able to explore, use, exploit archival, oral, archaeological, written, visual, linguistic, and landscape sources. Technologies including remote sensing, DNA analysis, chemical analysis of bone, and dating techniques. WTF? How? How? And yet you all swallow this nonsense from the Department of Education? They're not done. To develop an ability to understand and undertake a process of historical inquiry which uses a range of archaeological historical sources as evidence to make knowledgeable claims about the past. Give me any key. And I want them to show me they know how to do this. Number 9. African-centeredness is an outdated curriculum idea, and I speak as a curriculum theorist. Because what happens in Africa, or for that matter anywhere else, history in the modern world is always a relational construct. That is, what happens in Africa happens in relation to events elsewhere. And if COVID didn't convince you about that, nothing will. Take, for example, another act of triviality. This really angers me, because I was a kid trying to discover whether I should wear an afro or not at this time at UWC. Removing the American Civil Rights Movement from history, this is farcical. Given that there were powerful moments of interaction between black consciousness in South Africa and black consciousness in the USA that transformed politics here at home. This is where activists from Biko to Busak found their inspiration and indeed elaborated on that very powerful worldwide movement in the 60s and 70s. So why trivialize that electric moment in our history, especially one that had a direct influence on events leading to the Soweto uprising? Don't listen to the ANC. They had very little to do with the Soweto uprising. That had a lot to do with BC. Then think of the media sensationalism in the recent headlines. No more Jan van der Riebeek. First of all, he's been no more for a few curriculum revision cycles. Secondly, you cannot understand how Dutch colonialism penetrated the Cape unless you talk about the leader of the company's expedition. The history of nations can only be taught as a relational construct. Nothing happens anywhere in the colonized world without social, economic and political interactions that affect birth. How you tell that relational history is what matters in relation to the African condition. In short, the organizational axis around which the curriculum history is presented is wrong-headed. This curriculum theory is just nonsense. The moment calls not for African-centeredness, which is an outdated defensive posture from the 70s, but for African relationality. In other words, how do we understand what happened in South Africa or anywhere in Africa in relation to what happened in the rest of the world? And finally, number 10, the teaching and learning of history is always interpreted, never enforced. Teachers in conservative rural Afrikaans schools or private, mainly white English schools, and I've learned horror stories over the past 2 weeks, will teach history according to their own ideologies and perspectives, especially when there's no national examination to moderate the teaching, as is the case in the compulsory phase. It is a political pipe dream that this revised curriculum will transform the ideas of teachers or learners about our divided past. I've had over the years the opportunity to supervise outstanding doctoral students. One of the best, I think she was in a class with you, Marvia, was Tobs Gamede. So Tobs came to me with a very interesting idea. She designed a study to go and look at how history, two historical episodes, were taught at two schools. One was Pretoria Boys High School, and the other was Morris Isaacson High School in Soweto. Now, you might remember that Morris Isaacson was at the center of the ferment around the Soweto uprising. So she said, I'm going to watch how the history teacher at Pretoria Boys teaches the Sharpeville Massacre and the Soweto uprising. And then I'm going to look at how the Morris Isaacson teacher teaches the same two things. You know, when I read the transcripts, it was as if this was happening in two completely different countries. You seriously couldn't say this is in the same country. Why? Because the text is interpreted according to the preferences, the fears, the ideologies of each of those two teachers. They're not bad people. They're interpreting. You can't do that with physics, by the way. The atom, you've got to teach the atom, whether you like it or not. I don't think Pythagoras has 13 meanings for you. You know, you've got to teach Pythagoras the way it is, not so for history. And so we are naive if we put too much stake on this curriculum changing anything. Now, for the sake of my friend from News 24, let me say this in conclusion. It is my view, somebody who studied this stuff all my life, that the revised curriculum history proposal must be scrapped in its entirety, and they need to start afresh, or this thing will go the way of OBE. This will, of course, take a good dose of political humility, which is in short supply in this era of pala-pala politics. To be sensible, the following should happen in the revised history curriculum 2.0. Number one, make it simpler and accessible with attention to core concepts and methods only. Somebody asked me, Peter Calloway asked me the other day, what is the single most important thing we have learned about curriculum theory over 100 years? It's very simple. Less is more. In every discipline, take out the 6 or 7 concepts, I can give it to you for physics and life sciences, and teach that and send the kids home. Pack the curriculum with a whole lot of crap. Number two, for every suggestion about historical methods, force the department to guarantee that the resources and support for realizing those methods are in place first before you do it. Number three, at least 80% of the reconstituted panel must consist of experienced history teachers. some of whom should currently be in practice, including those from poor and working class schools. The role of academics and academic historians must be limited. They must be there, but it must be limited. Number four, transform not only content, but also the forms of assessment to give expression to the more progressive ideals of the history. It's no use you saying I've got a brand new history curriculum with archaeology and all this crap, and the assessment still requires you to do the same old stuff. This is the tail wagging the dog. It's a very old expression, as you know. Good. Number five, include all South Africans and their histories in the revised curriculum, and only those of Black Africans. Be generous and include all political traditions and not weigh our history in favor of two nationalist parties, the ANC and the NP. Number seven, make history intellectually exciting and engaging through funded programs that bring in new tools for teaching the subject. I have been working, Amanda knows about this, Ms. Keffers, on the work with Stanford University on doing these virtual tours of slave sites just here in Western Cape. It will blow your mind how without expensive travel back and forth to Gauteng or wherever, you could really make. Somebody asked me this morning at the school, how can I make my subject interesting? It's very simple, actually. Your students must feel that you're crazy about your subject. You must walk in there every single morning and their eyes must light up when you walk in and you have a question. You know, I asked the kids the other day, I came in and I said, hey, I took my scallopy to the spur, and fortunately you don't know what a scallopy is. I took my scallopy to the spur and I went to the toilet and there in the urinal was a lot of ice. Explain to me as a chemistry student why the ice is there. And for 20 minutes we had the most exciting expression. The next morning, hey, if a tree falls in the woods and nobody was around, did it make a sound? Give me the perspective of a physicist and give me the perspective of a psychologist of hearing. If your students don't get excited and you know, let me just go there. That's what this history curriculum should do instead of wasting our time with a lot of content. History, finally, unlike other subjects, will not go away. Work on a three-year plan for preparing teachers for the new curriculum and also embed that thinking in pre-service programs, which is why I brought my students here, for prospective history teachers. I conclude again with the words of my friend Peter Calloway, if history is not taught well, it is not worth teaching at all. Thank you.
Okay, great. I'm going to open up the floor now to questions. Prof, you can take this mic. I've got this one. And I'm live. Right. Right. Any questions? Thank you very much for that succinct and excellent talk. News 24 first.
Hello, my name is Anna Effensel. I'm from Network 24, which is like the Afrikaans newspaper, the Burger newspaper. Thank you, Prof. It's lovely to see you. Maybe you have addressed this somewhere, I did miss it, but I just want to ask you, what do you think about the discussion around making history a compulsory subject in school all throughout, up until the matric level?
This is Chappell being a butler. You'll be back in a minute, I think.
Okay. He's a professor of politics. He will tell you if you do something stupid like that, there will be a revolt on the streets of South Africa. So our government is corrupt, but it is not stupid. You know? It knows that if it does that, not the people in Lavendale and Montierville, the people here in Rondebosch and Claremont will be up on their hind legs. Because they know that that's a subject that doesn't enjoy the respect it deserves. In their minds, it doesn't give them economic benefit. They want their kids to do physics, math, life sciences, and something else, but not history. I checked this out with Mavi. I want to work on this. I don't know quite about what methodology to use yet. But to go and see who are the kids who actually do history in the FET phase, I guarantee you it's not the kids who are the high performers. There might be a few, but by and large, students do history because they don't want to do math and science. And they do history, there are a few again, and they do history because this is an easy way to, in their minds, to pass. And as Amanda said, and I'm quite sure students at other schools, they will come into grade 10 and say, I don't want to do this subject. So history is its own best enemy. And this revised history curriculum doesn't help us get out of that hole. So no, you rest assured, making it compulsory, our government isn't stupid. If they tried something like that.
Over here. Professor, I'm Sean Hewitt from Bishops. How fair are you with who was on this panel, who is in the panel making these decisions? Have you got insight into who's there and who's
not there?
I'd be keen to hear more.
No, I've interviewed most of them, and all of them made me put my hand on the Quran and say that I will not reveal their names.
Okay, so it's under wraps in terms of who's making these calls.
Well, I mean, I could eventually figure out who makes this call, but a very small group. I think they are dominated by academics, academic historians, people from NMU, UCT, that kind of place. But it's not loaded with people like yourself who are current history teachers who understand what it means to teach at Bishops, what it means to teach at Crestway, and how to make those things come together. It's not that kind of people. And that you'll see in the language of the document, teachers don't speak like it. It's a deep concern. And that's why I said, get 80% of the people to be practitioners, because you know what kids respond to and what they don't respond to. Okay.
Right, another question?
Right to the
back. I think you've convinced everybody.
Gracie?
Yes, is one of the table.
Stellenbosch.
I'd like to hear something from the Maritime.
I'm Grace Denty from Stellenbosch University, and I just want to ask, sir, why do you think practitioners and history teachers were excluded from the board of history practitioners who made this decision?
That's a good question. I think one of the reasons is in South Africa, we think that wisdom lies with academic historians. We disrespect our own profession. And this is true historically. If you look at the OBE panels, and these are friends of mine, Linda Chisholm, all of these, they're fantastic academics. They don't really know the routines and the rhythms of the school, the pressures of teachers. They don't know that. And so you would put on a SATU member who is there for other purposes, you know, or an NACOSA person. But those are union representatives. What you need to do in South Africa is to depoliticize some of these things and put it in the hands of ordinary teachers who are trying to make things work. And I've talked to probably 200 teachers in preparation for today, from Johannesburg to Durban, just to try and get a sense of what they're seeing in this curriculum. And the thing that worries them most is that their voices aren't being heard. So back to your question of why, I think in South Africa, you know, we think that qualifications, you know, merits inclusion in everything from judicial commissions to everything else. I mean, when racism breaks out at Stellenbosch, who do they have? A judge. Why? Why? It's to give legitimacy to a process, but you don't need a judge. You need a wise person. You need a decent person. It doesn't have to be a judge. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but that's a good question.
Professor Butler?
Thank you, Prof. Jansen. You talked about the ruling party as being responsible, and of course we don't have one of those. We don't have a governing party. We have a coalition government with a DA minister.
Mm.
And I wonder, what you make of that, what the significance of that is, and whether you condemn the minister and her party for not standing up against this curriculum?
Well, I think the GNU, which we've just had after a short time compared to the rest of our democratic period, is a very interesting body. You understand it better than I as a professor of politics. But it is a body in which the fact that there is Minister Gwarube doesn't mean she has any power. You know, that's a distinction never made between power, position, and authority and power. She doesn't have any power. So she would be trotted out and she'd make a profound statement on pit littering toilets. And I cringe because she doesn't know what she's talking about. We will wipe out pit littering, forgive me for mixing my metaphors, we would wipe out pit littering toilets in 10 years. She's never been in a situation. I could have told her how the construction mafia prevents a fire. So I think don't confuse the personality who's in charge of something and the power of the ANC behind the scenes to say what is going to happen. This curriculum panel is dominated by people from the ANC as opposed to people from the minister, the current minister's office. Yeah. And by the way, this thing has its origins, as you probably know, with Minister Mochega.
Yes. Could I just ask a follow-up?
Sure.
So you feel that the minister is essentially powerless in her department and that she's also disconnected from reality, such as the reality of pit latrines in schools. What should be done about that? Do you condemn the party for its inaction on having a powerless and poorly informed minister?
No, it wouldn't be a good use of my time to condemn up and down the GNU as TNAs in agriculture. I mean, it doesn't matter. This is a political arrangement for a particular period and will eventually, as you know, fall away. So I think fighting with those characters in a political agreement to keep the country together is a waste of time. One has to go and look. Need I tell you, where does the actual power lie? It doesn't lie in those personalities.
Right, we've got a question over there. Right.
Good day, everyone. My name is Vanessa Nyati, and I'm from Louis Homan Town Center. It was very nice meeting you. You're such an inspiration, sir. So I have two questions. My first question was, I wanted to ask, do you think that our current curriculum prepares young people like us for the real world out there? And then my second question was, what does it mean to you to be, what does it mean to be African to you? Mm. Thank you.
You know, I knew you were going to ask me difficult questions. That's a good question. Let me start with the second one and then you have to remind me of the first. What it means to be African to me means to be somebody who is deeply devoted to the people, the culture, the politics, the economics, the future of Africa. Okay, that's broad. It means that I do not harass a Zimbabwean because he or she works here when those borders were not set by Africans, they were set by colonial authorities. To be African to me means to be deeply committed to Africa, not as a geography, not as a region, but as an idea. To be African to me means to look out for all my people, whether they're white, green, blue, or pink. To be African to me means to understand that a white person born in this country, committed to this country, is as African as anybody else with a dark skin. To be African to me means that I respect you regardless of how you pray, regardless of how you make love when you marry, regardless of any of those things, you know, we attribute to people's identity. To be African to me means to be pan-African. That is, I am as... To be African to me means to defy the way we teach Africa as Africa south of the Sahara. Hello? Who made that up?
south of the Sahara. So to be African to me is unfortunately a minority view. Because all of us, and we're in a very dangerous moment again, I don't know if you read the news. We have, sorry for you've given me an opportunity to say this, we have a parliamentary portfolio committee on higher education that has gone after Africans from other African countries who are teaching in our universities. Do you know how dangerous that is? Do you know how out of step that is with the very idea of a university? Do you realize that UCT would mean nothing if you took out a Kali Chabali in chemistry cancer, one of the leaders in the world? My own university would mean nothing if you took out the head of agriculture, simply because he's from Nigeria. To be African to me means not to be focused on the narrowness of definition by race, culture, religion, or country of origin. That's what being African means to me. And God knows we've got an uphill struggle in that regard. The first question. Oh, no, it doesn't. It doesn't prepare you for the world of work at all.
So could you explain why?
And I'll tell you why. What do you want from a history student? I want a history student to be able to walk with me past the slave lodge and without ChatGPT say to me, you know what? This was a lodge in which this happened, that happened, these people were born. This was a lodge that, you know, despite the efforts of the colonialists, you had, you know, people falling in love, people parting together, people fighting together, people resisting the empire. I don't want somebody to say to me, you are the 10 facts about Jan van Riebeeck. Who the hell cares? I want you to have a sense of history as a present past. In other words, that the things I see today, sorry, this is my second language, but it's a beautiful expression, that it's a long aanloop. It comes from far away. It didn't just happen today. This is Mahmoud Mamdani's famous statement. The present doesn't explain itself. It has a history. That's what I want from it. But we don't prepare young people to think about history as a utility, as something I can use to explain the dilemmas we are in. Where do you think xenophobia comes about? Somebody didn't just wake up one day and sort of say, oh, let's attack all the non-South Africans in the market in Devon South. Just wake up. It comes from far in the past. We don't teach history that way. We teach history to prepare you for the exams. We teach history to make the school's reputation good. But we don't teach you, despite what the curriculum might say formally, to be curious, to be comfortable with uncertainty, to jump up and down when you see something you can't explain. We don't do that.
There's another question at that table first, and then I do see you.
Okay, you're guiding me, question.
Good day all. Good day, Prof. It's a pleasure meeting you today and standing before you. I'm truly grateful for the opportunity. I am Azalea Josephs from the Loyal Maritime Center, and I have two questions. So do you think that the curriculum is educating learners or more of shaping the ideology? And then secondly, do you think that the exposure or more exposure to more historical facts would help learners compare societies and think critically instead of viewing history from one angle and someone else's perspective? Thank you.
Great questions again, thank you. Now let me just say this, one of the tragedies of this curriculum is there's no history after 1996. Did you know that? Hello? How am I going to explain one of the biggest tragedies in South Africa, which was state capture under Jacob Zuma? You need to teach that stuff, okay? You need to understand how a whole lot of money left the fiscus, how collaboration with the Guptas almost brought this country to its knees economically. So why stop in 1996? Why not give us a count of these things? So yeah, it does, I think, and you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to think that this is done in order to keep us from knowing, you know, the calamity of the past
couple of decades, I definitely think, and no, again, you know, I don't think we're preparing young people to engage, and that is why the students that take, yesterday, by the way, I did yesterday, by the way, up to what is today called grade 12. It was the best decision I ever made, okay? But I had teachers at Stierberg High School who really were good at keeping me curious about both the distant and the present past.
Right, the question over there, that gentleman, has been waiting for a while.
South Africa, on a broad basis, I've been referred to Thomas Pakenham's South Africa. Thomas Pakenham would appear to have been like a Bible to most people. When I've been doing research, I've been referred to Thomas Pakenham. Cannot we get one of our well-renowned historians, like Beaver or Haskins, to write a book about Africa, not South Africa or parts of South Africa, but the whole of South Africa? These are professional authors in their own right, and maybe we could persuade them to talk about Africa as such on a basis which has not been taken into account in the recent past.
Yeah.
We're dealing with small sections of Africa here. We need the whole of Africa.
Yeah.
And these are the sort of people who would know about it, would be able to research and put it over in a very large compendium. And I think it would be a bestseller.
Thank you very much, sir. I appreciate that. Look, I think we've got a different problem. I certainly think there are some good books on Africa. Post-Pakenham. We have some of the best historians of Africa and South Africa as well in this country. Bong Nassim comes to mind, Albert Grundling and many others. There are outstanding thinkers in this country, but I take your point, an Africa-wide thinking. Here's the problem. Nobody reads books anymore. Did you know in South African universities, most of our students go through a 3-year or 4-year degree never having read a book from cover to cover? They get bloody notes, PowerPoint slides. My students complain bitterly. Where's the notes? What notes? You've got to be here to learn and to think. And then, of course, the ChatGPT and these large language models and sort of, so I don't think, I'm just going to ask Chat. So what did happen at the Battle of Blood River, you know, and that kind of nonsense. So, but the idea of bringing the book back in, I'm thinking, look, I'm getting old now, but I'm thinking of sort of still thinking of running my own university. And it would be a university with one degree, a BA, but it would be an interdisciplinary BA. And you will be required to read 5 books per year. You will read Plato. You will read, these big, you will need Native Life in South Africa. You will read A Brief History of Time. You will read my 5 favorite books. Instead of being trained, you will be educated. So just getting people to read that book, sir, let alone write it, in the current higher education system in South Africa, which is probably an adoption, okay, is a big struggle.
Yes, over here, please.
Good afternoon. Dominique Williams, former head of French at Rustenburg. I want to come back to what you say about the various teachers teaching according to their own passion. Don't we all glorify one's past and one's nation's past? Everywhere, I can tell you, because I've experienced it, the way they teach the First World War in England is totally different from the way they teach the First World War in France. In France, we will talk about Gallipoli.
Surprise me.
We'll talk about Gallipoli. Gallipoli will be swept very quickly in England, you know. So what you say, it's true, it's right. how can you counter that? There is nothing in your degree which say you have to have a test of, I don't know, what your political affiliations are, what your feelings are.
Yeah.
How can we counteract that? It's obvious that somebody in the township will see the 16th of June differently from somebody who didn't experience it in the same way, even if you are sympathetic, if you are knowledgeable, if you know what you're talking about.
Yeah. And thank you, and you're right, of course. Look, my whole point was that I have higher standards for South Africa than I have for England and France. In other words, I get your point. I remember what I said. Have we reached maturity as a country in which we can talk about our light and our shadows? Now, one of the pillars in this curriculum, you'll see it in each of the three booklets, is multi-perspectivity, whatever that means. But it's the idea of not brainwashing young people, but presenting them with a historical event and saying to them, okay, let's look at three different perspectives about the Boer War or about whatever the case might be. That sounds like a sensible thing to me. The problem is, what happens when what you're confronting is a moral dilemma? I don't want to hear three different perspectives on apartheid. If one of those perspectives is, oh, maybe it was a necessary thing for black people to be, you know, that kind of racist rubbish. However, it is true that within the broad intellectual environment, there are people who think of apartheid as a racial system, but there are also people who think about it as a capitalist accumulation model. I think our students should engage that. Do you know what I mean? And so on and so forth. But what I don't want them to do, what I don't want any government to do, is say this is the way, walkie in it, because then we're in trouble. By the way, talking about Europe, I almost got killed in the Catholic part of Belfast last year. Yeah, because being a culture vulture, I wanted to see both sides. By the way, they have made no progress compared to South Africa. South Africans are very tolerant and get along, you know. Well, I don't think so. That's another debate. I think it's politics. But so I get into the Catholic section. They're so Catholic and so anti the crown that every book in the small library is in Gaelic. Okay? And they would say to me, you see that place over there? That's where we bombed the British soldiers. And so I'm sitting in this place, partly terrified and partly, you know. But because I'm a creature of habit, so in this little Catholic area, in this cafe, the waitress came along and she said, what are you having to drink? And because I've always said the same thing, I said to her, English breakfast. Oh my God. My friend grabbed me and he said, make that Irish coffee. I mean, just to say. Oh no, they wouldn't even hear you. You're right.
But no.
I know, but can I just give you a contrast? Did you know in Rwanda, post the genocide, the school history text makes no reference to the genocide? You're not supposed to teach. That's the other extreme.
Right. Question over there, Potato? Yes.
Good afternoon to everyone. My name is Annelien Lovo from Loyalty Maritime Center. My question, I wanted to ask, sir, that doesn't he think that being taught apartheid raises some sort of discrimination or racism between one another? Because from my own opinion, I believe that when we learn about what happens to Africans, it shapes a young person's point of view about a particular group of people.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you for not having two questions as the maritime. That's a great question, actually, and I want to answer it this way. I think it's important to talk about apartheid, not as a way of accusing people of doing bad things, because most of us were not around at the time, but as a way of making us conscious that the way the world is organized around us is not an accident. Give me a simple example of that, okay? Right here where we are.
I can pretend that until recently in historical time, did you know in this place you and I would not have been allowed in, and Jews would not have been allowed in. Now I can say, oh, look at the beautiful weather, okay, that would be a stretch. Look at the mountains, we're next to a world famous cricket ground. I can say all of those things, but not to acknowledge, okay, the shadows, the bad things, is to be intellectually dishonest. Okay, so I think we should teach kids apartheid, but you must teach it with complexity in mind, with nuance in mind. For example, in this book, except for a singular line on Alan Joseph, there's no mention of whites fighting apartheid. Wasn't a lot of them, but there were whites. I want to hear about the conscription campaign. Go and read up about it. I want to hear about the black sash. I want to hear about whites in the Communist Party. In other words, give a sense of South African history so that people don't walk away, young people, with the idea there was good blacks and bad whites. Mm. It's how you teach it, not whether. Great question.
And I think we have time for one more, also from that table, please. Thank you.
Good day to the House at large. My name is Deanda Morachane from Low Hill Maritime Center. And my question, well, two questions. The first one is, in my research that I've done about the curriculum that the government wants to set in place, it said that this discussion is open to the public. But my concern is that the actual text that the curriculum encompasses is not available to the public. From what I've researched, the information that I have is that it is Afrocentric, but from what Sir has conveyed, it actually isn't. So how can other people form a conclusion without hearing both sides of the story and actually getting to read the actual text itself? And my other question is that, is a young person like us in the panel of the final decision that's going to be made?
Thank you very much. So in regards to the last question, no. And that's a mistake. I really would have liked to see young people from different, in the reference groups or somewhere, giving their sense as to why history is or isn't exciting to them, what can be done, and so on and so forth. I agree with that part. The first question was about not being available. It's actually available, but you have to look for it. And so your point remains. I think what should have happened is, even if it's in summary form, because these are thick documents, make it available in every school, in every church and mosque, in every, you know, make these things available, but then ask people to participate when you have to search for the stuff, you know, on the internet. That would be a genuine public deliberation on something as important as history, but I don't think it is widely available. In fact, when I talked to some history teachers, they said, we don't have it. I had to send them the links, which I got from a journalist, by the way.
We've got one more question, actually, right at the back. You?
Hi, everyone. I'm Jordan Francois from Stellenbosch, one of Prof's students. And Professor, I wanted to ask, on a practical note, how are we supposed to teach, like, if this curriculum is put in place, how are we supposed to teach students how to argue and give opinions when the content is so heavy? When it's such a content-heavy curriculum, practically, how do we create critical thinkers and historically empathetic students?
Right. Great question. You might recall Dr. Cranfield being there to talk with you guys about compliance versus comprehension, that kind of thing. So this is how I would do it, and I speak as a former teacher or current teacher who tries to do it. The first thing is, you've got to operate at two levels. On the one hand level, you've got to operate in a way that gives your curriculum advisor what they want. Just do it. On the other hand, you say, okay, what else can I do? It might take another hour in the week. It might mean bringing them in every third Saturday in the morning. That's what we're doing at Keshwar at the moment.
with physics. It might mean doing something else, but I'm not going to sacrifice, okay, the opportunity to teach you deeply, to teach you critically, to teach you expansively, to teach you simply because I have this sword hanging over my head that says the exams are coming. We at the height of apartheid, you're in Cape Town, I was a teacher at Trafalgar High School. The teachers did two things. The one is they taught the curriculum to get you to pass, and then they had a parallel curriculum, okay, to teach you about historical consciousness, about what is happening in the country and that kind of thing. Is that easy? No. Does it mean it will take more of your time? Yes. Does it mean you might sometimes have to get resources, right, that might not readily be available? Yes. But you have the one opportunity with a class of children, or six classes, depending on what you teach, to change their minds about the subject. And you cannot simply wash your hands and sort of say, oh, you know, I'm a victim of a content-heavy curriculum, and just get on with it. You have to use that time to be different, to be radical, to do other things as well. Good teachers find a way of doing that, okay? But it is tiring and exhausting and all of that.
Thank you very much. We are going to wrap it up now. I know that one or two people might want to ask a question. Prof will be around. You can ask him directly in the next while. Thank you very much. That was a good afternoon. And we hope to have you back soon. And we'll see what happens with this curriculum.
Stop. Yes.